been in her chest again. But this time, there was something else, too. Something that felt like terror and pain. Glory stopped and looked back at her. "What's wrong? What are they doing to that elephant?" she said.
"Trying to teach it new tricks," Glory said. "They've been having trouble with that one."
"It looks like they're torturing it." "It doesn't hurt her." Lily searched Glory's face with watery eyes. "How do you know?" Glory gazed at her for a long moment, then started walking again.
"I don't," she said in a quiet voice.
Lily stared at the ground and followed. She couldn't look at the elephant again. Just like when she saw the lion, she could feel every twinge of the elephant's fear, every stab of pain and confusion. The weight of it pressed in all around her, as if she were being swallowed by mud or quicksand. When they neared the train, Glory slowed.
"Listen," she said. "We're on in a few hours, and Mr. Barlow is like a bear with his leg caught in a trap before we open the doors. So don't speak unless you're spoken to."
Merrick was waiting for them outside one of the passenger cars, pacing and wringing his hands. Unlike the rest of the passenger cars, which were green or brown or gray, this one was painted a glossy red and trimmed with decorative black scrolls. Tasseled curtains hung in the windows below gold lettering that read, "The Barlow Brothers Circus." Beside Merrick, two men stood on either side of the car steps. One was bald, with mean-looking eyes and hairy arms. The other seemed as big as a horse, his short-sleeved shirt stretched over his chest like it was about to rip open. His black hair was in a knot on top of his head.
"You see those men?" Glory said under her breath. "Don't ever mess with them. They're Mr. Barlow's strongmen. They protect him and work as patches when things get rough with the townies."
Lily could only nod. "What took you so long?" Merrick said. Before Glory could answer, he grabbed Lily by the arm and took her up the metal steps to a platform between Mr. Barlow's car and the next. Glory started up the steps behind them, but Merrick told her to wait outside. Then he lifted his chin, cleared his throat, and rapped on the door. Lily waited beside him, her heart kicking like a jackrabbit in her chest.
"Enter," a baritone voice called from inside.
Merrick opened the door and told Lily to enter first. Fancy light fixtures decorated the shiny wood walls of the car. Along with two upholstered chairs, a velvet sofa, a round table, and flowered rugs scattered here and there like playing cards. A small sink, countertop, and cupboard sat against one wall, and two wooden fans whirred on the ceiling. Behind a beaded curtain, an open doorway led into another room. The smell of smoke, old wood, and warm dust filled the air, reminding Lily of her bedroom back home. Homesickness washed over her, and she was overcome by a sudden falling sensation. As if the weight of her head had grown too heavy for her neck and was pulling her over. Somehow, she stayed upright and gritted her teeth until the feeling passed. A man in a suit, cufflinks, and shiny shoes sat in a red chair, a plate of eggs and a cup of coffee on the round table in front of him. His waxed blonde mustache twitched over gray teeth that looked too big for his mouth.
"What is it?" he said.
"I picked up a new act at the last stop," Merrick said. "Something we've never had before."
"Step forward," Mr. Barlow said to Lily.
Lily did as she was told. Her mouth felt full of sawdust.
"What's her billing?" Mr. Barlow said.
"I'm not sure," Merrick said. "Got any ideas?"
Mr. Barlow spun a finger in the air and ordered Lily to turn. Moving slowly so she wouldn't get dizzier, she did as she was told. Mr. Barlow took a sip of coffee and stared at her, drumming his fingers on the table. Then he rose from his chair.
"Alana!"
he shouted, making Lily jump.
Come out here.
In another room, someone groaned and bedsprings squeaked.
What?
A female voice whined. Mr. Barlow scowled. Come here, he said. And don't make me say it again.
Ugh, Christ on a cracker,
Alana mumbled. Then she called out in a cheerful voice,
I'll be right there.
More sounds came out of the room. Feet hitting the floor, a heavy sigh, jewelry clinking, a drawer being opened and closed. After a long minute, Alana pushed the beaded curtain to one side and entered the room in a white robe, opened at the waist, and undergarments made out of lace. Lipstick smudged her mouth like red fingerprints, and her long hair was a tangled mess of blonde curls. The pink of her nipples showed through the thin fabric of her brassiere. Behind her, a small brown dog trotted into the room. Alana smiled at Mr. Barlow.
What is it, dear?
Lily lowered her eyes. Didn't anyone care that Alana was nearly naked? When the dog saw Merrick, it barked and charged at him, baring its teeth and growling, its hair raised. Then it suddenly came to a halt and eyed Lily. It dropped its head, went over to her, sat up on its hunches, and pawed the air, begging to be picked up and petted.
Well, I'll be damned, Alana said. She's never done that before. Chi-Chi hates everybody but me.
She went over and kneeled next to the dog and gazed up at Lily.
You want to pet her?
Lily nodded, got down on one knee, and touched the dog's little head. Chi-Chi rolled over to expose her tiny tan belly, her tail wagging wildly. Lily rubbed the dog's belly, and for the first time in what seemed like forever, smiled.
I've never seen her act like that with anyone, Alana said. She even tries biting Sid if he gets too close.
She glanced over her shoulder.
Isn't that right, darling?
If that idiot dog bites me, I'll stomp it into the ground, Mr. Barlow said.
Alana ignored him and directed her attention back to Lily.
Have you always had a way with animals?
She scratched Chi-Chi's chest with long pink fingernails. Lily shrugged.
I don't believe I've had the pleasure, Alana said. What's your name, honey?
Before Lily could answer, Mr. Barlow said,
We're trying to come up with her show name. That's why I called you out here, not to play with that stupid dog.
Alana rolled her eyes and kept scratching Chi-Chi.
Well, what's her act? Where is she going to be working?
Where the hell do you think? Mr. Barlow said. In the freak show.
Alana pressed her lips together and stopped petting the dog. She straightened and pulled her robe closed, tying it tight at the waist.
Call her whatever you want, she said. You will anyway.
God damn it, Mr. Barlow said. Sometimes I wonder why I keep you around.
Alana shot him a cold smile and strolled back toward the bedroom.
You know perfectly well why you keep me around.
Mr. Barlow caught her by the arm.
Stay here. I need ideas.
Alana pulled away and plopped down on the velvet sofa, pouting. Chi-Chi flipped over onto her feet, scurried over to the sofa, and jumped up to sit beside her owner. Alana took a cigarette from a silver case on the table, put it between her smudged red lips, lit it, and blew out a stream of smoke with more force than necessary. Then she cocked her head slightly and fixed her eyes on Lily, thinking.
Well, she's perfect, she said. When I saw her, the first thing I thought of was a porcelain doll.
She took another drag from her cigarette, crossed her legs, and leaned forward.
How about the world's only living porcelain doll? Or a real porcelain doll alive and breathing?
Smoke curled from her mouth when she talked.
Not exotic enough, Mr. Barlow said. We want to shock and amaze people, not bore them to death.
Alana rolled her eyes again, then took another drag from her cigarette.
How about the swan girl? Or we could put her in a wedding dress and call her the ghost bride.
I think we should bill her as some kind of princess, Merrick said.
That might work, Alana said.
She's different because her skin is so white. So you need something that makes sense, like the frozen princess or the ice princess.
I've got it, Mr. Barlow said. The ice princess from another planet.
Alana shook her head and leaned back in the sofa. One arm across her middle, the other bent at the elbow, her cigarette in the air. Mr. Barlow ignored her.
It's perfect, right?
He asked Merrick. Merrick shrugged and mumbled something under his breath.
What's that? Mr. Barlow said. Nothing, Merrick said.
He said it's stupid, Alana said.
Shut up, Alana, Mr. Barlow said.
Anger pinched Alana's face. She crushed her cigarette out in an ashtray, got up, and went back to the bedroom. Chi-Chi jumped off the couch and followed her.
You think it's stupid? Mr. Barlow asked Merrick. No, but I'm not sure what being Ice Princess has to do with being from another planet. She's supposed to be an alien? Because that's not what I had in mind.
Well, the name of this circus might be the Barlow Brothers, Mr. Barlow said. But I'm the only brother left. Not to mention, I'm the one paying the bills around here. Do yourself a favor and remember that.
Merrick clenched his jaw, his temples moving in and out.
You know damn well your brother had every intention of leaving me his half, he snarled. Maybe, maybe not. The only thing I know for sure is he didn't have time to change his will between making a move on Alana and drowning in that river. You're my cousin, Merrick, and only a second cousin at that. You're lucky I let you run the sideshows.
I own the sideshows.
No, dear boy, you don't. You might own a few of the acts, and Victor will always be loyal to you. But I own the tents, and the banners, and the stages. I own the ticket booths and employ the people who run them.
Maybe so, but Lily's my act. I should decide her billing.
Mr. Barlow jutted out his chin and took a step closer to Merrick.
Listen, pisshead. Without me, you wouldn't have a circus for her act. I own the big top and the animals and the wagons. I pay the people who set it all up. I even own the train that hauls your sorry ass from one show to the next. Now get the hell out of my car before I throw you out.
Merrick stomped over to the door and yanked it open, his face the color of beets. He ordered Lily out and slammed the door behind them. Glory was waiting outside, sharing a cigarette with the bald strongman.
Let's go,
Merrick said. He stormed toward the other end of the train. Glory gave the cigarette back to the strongman and hurried to catch up. Lily followed.
What happened? Glory said.
Merrick ignored her and kept going, his hands and fists. Then he stopped and let loose a string of curses.
That arrogant bastard might know what he's talking about when it comes to the big top, but he doesn't know a damn thing about the freak show.
What did he say? Glory said.
Merrick started walking again.
I don't want to talk about it.
Well, I've got to get ready for my performance, Glory said. I'll take Lily over to the twins' car. She can stay there for now. They've got room.
Merrick shook his head.
No, she's staying with us.
But,
Glory started. Merrick stopped again and glared at her.
No buts. I'm not giving her the chance to try to escape.
Escape and go where? She's just a little girl.
I don't care, Merrick said. She's staying in our car where we can keep an eye on her, and that's final. It's either that or back in the stock car with the goats and llamas.
Glory gave Lily a worried glance.
Okay, she said. But I'll take her to the dressing tent with me while I get ready.
No, you won't be making it back to the train before the show opens without the rubes seeing you.
He started walking again. Now come on! Glory and Lily trailed Merrick past the next three cars, then climbed the steps of the fourth and waited while he unlocked the door. The inside of the car looked the same as Mr. Barlow's, except with faded, torn furniture, dull paneling, and no ceiling fans. Dirty glasses filled the small sink, and a set of yellow curtains hung in the open doorway between the two rooms, their edges stained gray. The air felt hot and thick, like the air in Lily's attic bedroom in the middle of summer. Lily did not like the place. Merrick tromped over to a sideboard, opened a bottle, and poured brown liquid into a glass. Glory picked a newspaper and a rumpled blanket off the couch and straightened the pillows. "You can sleep here," she said to Lily. She lifted an overflowing ashtray off a table piled high with magazines and brushed fallen ashes to the floor. "Sorry, it's such a mess." Standing frozen by the door, Lily didn't know what to do or say. This was her new home, whether she liked it or not. She pictured her old room, her lumpy bed, her stained pillow, Abby sleeping on her woolen blanket. The sudden realization that this was final, that she was never going to see any of it again, that she was never going to see Abby again, hit her like a sledgehammer. It was the worst feeling in the world. Her eyes flooded and her lungs started to close. She tried counting the floorboards to calm down, but it didn't help. Glory saw what was happening, came over and knelt beside her. "It's okay," she said. "Just breathe. I know it's a lot to get used to, but I'll take care of you, I promise." After several long minutes of struggling to get air, Lily's chest finally loosened, and she stumbled over to the sofa and collapsed into it, her face smeared with tears and sweat. Her vision grew blurry, and she closed her eyes. She was exhausted and wanted to disappear into sleep, but her mind wouldn't stop spinning. She needed to come up with a plan. She needed to get out of there and go home. Maybe this afternoon, when the circus opened and Merrick and Glory left the car to go to work, she could sneak out and follow the railroad tracks in the other direction, toward Blackwood Manor. She had no idea how long it would take to walk home, but she didn't care. Maybe she could steal some food and a blanket and sleep in the woods at night. At least it wasn't winter. She pictured herself crossing her parents' fields and walking across the lawn, marching up the steps and knocking on the front door. Daddy would answer, surprised and happy to see her. Mama might be mad at first, but if Lily promised to be good, promised to stop asking for things she couldn't have, and promised to memorize the Bible and say her prayers every night, maybe Mama would let her stay. Then she thought of something else and started to tremble. What if Daddy wasn't happy to see her? What if he knew all along Mama was going to sell her to the circus? After all, he let Mama lock her in the attic. If he really loved her, he wouldn't have done that. And what if he really wasn't long for this world? What if he really was dying? The thought made her feel like she was falling off a cliff, her arms and legs limp and useless, her hair fluttering around her face and head. She buried her face in a pillow and sobbed. Glory knelt beside her. "It's all right. Go ahead and cry. You have every right to be sad and mad and scared and all of those things. It's not fair what your mama did to you. When my parents dropped Victor off at the asylum, I was 6 and he was 5. But God help me, I remember thinking how glad I was that they were leaving him there instead of me, because he was crying so hard and I..." Merrick slammed his glass on the sideboard. "For Christ's sake, Glory," he snarled. "Quit your blubberin'. The show starts in an hour and you need to get ready." Glory got to her feet, wiping her palms on her skirt. "Don't you think it'd be okay if I sit this one out? Others have missed shows before. I should stay here with Lily and..." With that, Merrick flew across the room and slapped her hard across the face. She staggered backward and nearly fell, but managed to stay on her feet. Lily sat up, breathing hard. Glory put her hand to her cheek and gaped at Lily, her eyes wide with shame and fear. Then, without a word, she hung her head and went into the other room. "You better be getting your things together," Merrick yelled. He went over to the sideboard and poured himself another drink. Lily watched from the sofa, her fingers digging into the cushions. A moment later, Glory came out of the other room with what looked like a miniature suitcase in one hand.
A red mark in the shape of a handprint colored her cheek, and she gazed at Lily with glassy eyes.
"I'll be back as soon as the show is over. I'm sorry I can't stay."
Lily wanted Glory to stay more than anything, but there was nothing she could do. She watched her leave, then curled up in a corner of the sofa, wondering what would happen next. Merrick locked the door behind Glory and disappeared into the other room. Somewhere a door opened and closed. Lily held her breath and listened. Was there another way out of the car in the other room? The only thing she heard were the violent thud of her heart and what sounded like water running. She got up, tiptoed across the room, and tried the door that led outside, even though she knew it was locked. She tried the windows. It was no use. Everything was bolted shut. She sat down again and tried to think. Then the door in the other room opened and closed again, and Merrick whistled as he moved about in there. A few minutes later, he came out in a suit and tie. His hair slicked back from his cratered face. The smell of shoe polish and cologne filled the room, reminding Lily of Daddy. Merrick poured another drink, came over to the sofa, stood over her, and grinned. She swallowed and pushed her back into the cushions.
"You and I are going to make a lot of money together," he said. "But right now, I've got to get over to the sideshow."
He swallowed the contents of his glass and headed for the door. As she watched him go, the tightness left Lily's shoulders. After he left, maybe she could pound on a window to get someone's attention, or break it and crawl out. Then Merrick realized his glass was still in his hand and went over to set it on the sideboard. She tensed again, and before she knew what was happening, he rushed toward her, clawed hands outstretched. She screeched and tried to scramble off the sofa, but he clamped his fingers into her upper arms and dragged her into the other room. She thrashed and kicked and clawed, but couldn't get away. He hauled her past a chair piled with clothes and a bed covered with tangled blankets, then opened a wooden door and shoved her into a small room. She stumbled and fell between a wall and a toilet, and he slammed the door, casting the room into blackness. A horrible stench filled her nostrils, and she gagged. She got to her feet and pounded on the door, screaming for him to let her out.
"Sorry, kid," he said through the wood, "but the show must go on."
Chapter 8. Julia. The morning after her return to Blackwood Manor, Julia woke with a start, her head bent at an odd angle against the arm of the overstuffed couch. At first, she didn't know where she was. Then she recognized the marble fireplace and the ornate tin ceiling of her late parents' living room. Now the living room, the entire house in fact, belonged to her. It felt surreal and a bit unsettling. She sat up, stretched, and rubbed her stiff neck. The room was cold and gray, and she could almost see her breath. Sometime during the night, the fire had gone out. She stood, walked over to the windows, and pushed back the velvet curtains. Warm shafts of sunlight burst through the glass, illuminating the dusty air and creating blocks of light on the red Persian rug. A strong wind pushed against the window frame and creaked against the panes. Mother's dead rose bushes scratched along the sill. Outside, the brown front lawn stretched out for what seemed like forever toward a line of towering oak trees. A white plank fence and the one-lane road that led into town in one direction and the Adirondack foothills in the other. A band of black starlings filled the swaying tree branches, and a gray pickup truck lumbered along the way, its exhaust like swirling ice in the air. Even in the sunshine, everything looked lonely and cold.
After she got the fireplace going again, she went into the kitchen and turned on the tea kettle. The first thing on her to-do list was to figure out how to turn the furnace up. Then she could start exploring. She opened the drawer beside the stove and stared at one of the great mysteries of her childhood, Mother's keys. She could still picture the key ring hanging from Mother's apron, brass and iron clicking as she strode up and down the stairs, through the rooms and halls like a cat with a bell on its collar. While growing up, Julia had often wondered why there were so many keys on the ring, and where Mother kept them at night. Could it be that they were in this drawer all along? No, it was impossible. Mother never let them out of her sight. How many times had she seen Mother reading or knitting, one hand checking to make sure the keys were still tied to her apron? 100? 1,000? Julia took a deep breath and touched the keys, half expecting to hear Mother's chiding voice warning her to leave them alone. But there was no voice, no electric shock, no scolding slap of an invisible, cold ghost hand. She picked up the ring and was surprised to find it weighed more than expected. There were 17 keys, each one unique, short and long, brass and iron, thick and thin, ornate and plain. And now, like everything else in Blackwood Manor, they belonged to her. She took the keys, grabbed her suitcase from the foyer, and went up to her old room. The second floor featured a long center hallway, with two hallways leading off each side. Julia's bedroom was at the top of the stairs, the first door on the left. As she suspected, it was locked. She tried 5 different keys before finding the right one, then finally turned the lock and opened the door, thinking briefly how odd it was that she didn't know which key belonged to her old room. The bedroom was freezing and looked exactly the same as it did the night she left, except for the cobwebs hanging from the stuffed calico elephant on the shelf above her headboard, and the dust graying every surface, including the pictures of dogs and cats taped to her dresser mirror. She entered and stood in the middle of the room, shivering and still holding her suitcase. 1,000 memories flooding her mind. This was where she had spent countless lonely hours, banished for the smallest violation of Mother's rules, or doing homework, wishing she had a brother or sister, sobbing into her pillow after being picked on in school. After a long minute, she turned around and walked out. She didn't have to stay in her old bedroom. She could stay in a different one. After all, there were 6 on this floor alone. She closed the door, put the key in the lock, and started to turn it, then changed her mind. There was no longer any reason to keep her old bedroom locked. Not that there ever was, except for Mother's insistence it be that way. She carried her suitcase toward the end of the hall, Mother's keys jangling against her hip. The sound reminded her of lying in bed every night, the clinking of keys outside her bedroom as Mother checked the doors up and down the hall. For what? Julia had no idea. She stopped in front of the room opposite her parents' bedroom, what Mother called the playroom, the only other bedroom she was allowed in while growing up. As usual, the playroom was unlocked. Inside, gray light filtered in around the curtains, and a mint-green rug embroidered with roses and leaves covered the plank floor like a thick layer of lime sherbet. A brass daybed with ruffled pillows and a white comforter sat against one wall, opposite a blue-painted armoire between 2 tall windows. Unlike Julia's bedroom, this one had been kept free of dust and cobwebs. As a child, she had spent hours in the playroom, combing her doll's hair, feeding them bottles, rocking them to sleep, kissing their foreheads. Thinking about it now gave her heart a strange twist. Mother was the one who taught her how to cuddle babies and lay them gently into their beds. She was the one who told her to pat the dolls' backs and sing them to sleep. Now, Julia couldn't imagine it. She pushed the image of Mother from her mind and concentrated on the here and now. Trying to figure out the woman who had brought her into this world at an age when most mothers were watching their children get married or sending them off to college wouldn't change anything. Mother was who she was, and now she was gone. She set her suitcase next to the armoire, pushed open the drapes, and looked out a window. The playroom overlooked part of the side yard, where six gnarled apple trees ringed a small lawn. Whenever she was being too loud or trying Mother's patience during summer vacation, she was sent there to play, while the grown-ups drank iced tea and whiskey at a wicker table on the terrace. Over the tops of the apple trees, the butter-colored horse barn and white paddocks sat surrounded by brown fields. Three horses grazed in a round pen, while two men looked on. One stood with his hands on his hips. The other had his foot on the bottom fence plank, his arms crossed and resting over the top. The man with his hands on his hips looked like Claude, but she had no idea who the other one was. Then she noticed the gray pickup truck she had seen on the road earlier sitting in the barn driveway. Maybe the other man was the veterinarian. She opened her suitcase, found a thicker sweater, and put it on, wondering if Claude knew how to turn up the furnace. She had no idea if the house was heated with wood or coal, or where the thermostat was located. After all, she was only a teenager when she left, and she had never been interested in those things anyway. Not that anyone would have explained them to her if she'd asked. Somewhere in the back of her mind, she remembered her father going into the basement to adjust the valves. But she wasn't sure what that meant. If Claude didn't know what to do, she'd have to figure it out herself, or hire someone. She brushed her hair in the mirror, pulled it into a ponytail, and went back downstairs. In the kitchen, the tea kettle was screaming. Hot water boiled from its spout and sizzled on the flame beneath it. She turned off the burner and, without thinking, grabbed the tea kettle handle. Shit! She dropped the tea kettle on the stove and went over to the sink to run her red, tender palm under the faucet. How was she ever going to take care of this place if she couldn't even make tea without messing it up? She stared at the running water, wondering if she should quit while she was ahead. Someone knocked on the mudroom door and she jumped. Shit, she said again. She shut off the water, wiped her hands on her pants, and went into the mudroom. Maybe it was Claude, and she could ask him about the furnace. She opened the door. It wasn't Claude. A man in rubber boots, a black toque, and a green barn jacket stood on the steps with his back to her, watching the horses in the round pen. May I help you? Julia said. The man spun around and took the toque from his head. Sorry, he said. You caught me daydreaming. I'm Fletcher. He grinned and thrust out a hand. Fletcher Reed. I'm here to see Miss Blackwood. He was tall and lean and looked to be in his late 20s, with a square jawline and chocolate-colored eyes. His short, sandy hair stuck out in all directions above his tanned, rugged face. She shook his hand. His handshake was sturdy, his skin rough. I'm Miss Blackwood, she said. His brows shot up.
You're the new owner?
Yes.
But you're so...
Heat rose in her cheeks. I know. I'm too young to own this place. His face filled with instant regret.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. It's none of my business. Please, forgive me.
He glanced over his shoulder, as if plotting a quick getaway, then gave her a broad smile.
Can we start over?
She shrugged one shoulder.
Sure.
He shook her hand again. I'm the vet. She hesitated, surprised. For some reason, she expected the veterinarian to be old, like Claude, with a bristled face and age-spotted hands. She couldn't have been more wrong. He looked like one of the surfers she used to watch on Long Island.
"Pleased to meet you," she said. "I'm Julia."
"Pleased to meet you too, Julia.
Claude and I were wondering if you'd come over to the barn and take a look at the horses."
"Me?"
He nodded.
"Is something wrong? Because I don't..."
"No, it's nothing like that. A buyer is interested in a couple of our... I mean, your stallions. We were wondering if you wanted to sell or not."
She frowned. Why were they asking her to make decisions already? She had just arrived and didn't know the first thing about horses.
"I don't know. I..." She groaned and sighed. Suddenly, she couldn't string two words together.
"He's going to think I'm an idiot."
"Whatever you think will be best for the farm. I trust you and Claude to make the right decision."
"All right," he said. "I know what Claude is thinking, but he said we had to ask you first. Are you sure you don't want to come and take a look? They're some of our best stallions yet. Perfect specimens from Blackwood Farm's most famous lineage. When you see them, you'll know what I mean."
She thought about it for a moment, then shrugged. There was no harm in looking, and she had to go over to the barn sooner or later. Not to mention she needed to ask Claude how to turn up the furnace.
"Okay. Better grab your coat," he said. "It's a cold one out there today."
She opened the door wide and stepped back.
"Please, come in and stay warm while I get it."
He entered the mudroom, closed the door behind him, and waited with his hat in his hand at the edge of the kitchen while she went to get her coat.
"Nice house," he called after her. "It's got a great kitchen."
She grabbed her coat from the foyer closet and hurried back to where he stood.
"You've never seen it?"
He shook his head.
"Mrs. Blackwood was an odd duck. She never allowed us inside. If we needed something, we had to call on the barn phone."
She pushed her arms into her coat and buttoned it up.
"That sounds about right. My mother loved rules."
He grimaced. "Sorry. I didn't realize the former owner was your mother. I thought she was a long-lost aunt or something."
She smiled. "Don't worry. If anyone knows how odd my mother was, it's me."
She started to take her crocheted beanie out of her coat pocket, but changed her mind. It was dirty, and the edge was starting to unravel. Then she realized her coat wasn't in much better shape. If Fletcher and Claude knew how she'd been living the last 3 years, they'd never take her seriously. She stuffed the beanie back in her pocket, at the same time realizing she couldn't go over to the barn wearing Keds. She quickly scanned the mudroom for something to wear, and for the first time since her return, noticed Mother's barn boots in their usual spot beneath the bench. She slipped off her sneakers and pushed her feet into the rubber boots as if she'd done it 100 times, despite the fact that they were 2 sizes too big. Somehow, it felt wrong to put them on. She stood and did her best to ignore the hollows and lumps in the soles, misshapen from years of wear and tear beneath Mother's bunioned feet.
"Claude didn't tell you I was Coraline's daughter?" she said, trying to act calm and composed.
"If there's one thing about Claude," Fletcher said, "it's that he does his job and keeps his mouth shut. He never breaks the rules or gets into anyone's business."
"Well, that's good to know. So why didn't you call me on the barn phone?"
"It was disconnected after your mother, I mean Mrs. Blackwood, passed. Claude didn't see any reason to have it working again until you arrived."
She started toward the door.
"Makes sense to me. I'll call and have it connected again."
He grinned, put on his toque, opened the door, and held it for her. They left the house, and she walked beside him toward the barn, her hands in her pockets. Her hair whipped in her eyes, and a cold wind made her nose run, making her wish she'd worn her hat despite its appearance. Maybe later she'd find a more suitable coat and hat in the house, until she could buy new ones anyway. Unfazed by the harsh wind, Fletcher turned his face to the sun and strode across the lawn, scanning the distant horizon. Then he turned his head and smiled at her, as if going out to the barn together was something they did every day. Unlike Julia, who hated awkward silences and always tried to fill them with conversation, he seemed completely at ease with the silence between them. Somehow, walking side by side was enough. Then again, she didn't like small talk either, so she was glad he wasn't commenting on the weather or landscape. Life was too big and too short and too important to talk about the lack of rain or the latest gossip. She wanted to know how people felt about themselves and one another, whether they were happy or sad. She wanted to know what made them feel loved and what hurt them to the core. She wanted to know about their past, how they got where they were, and their relationships with their mothers and fathers and siblings. She wanted to know if she was the only mixed-up person in the world who felt completely and utterly alone. But she couldn't ask Fletcher about any of those things, and she had to say something. "How long have you worked at Blackwood Manor?" she asked. "I don't just work here. I work at farms all over the county." "Of course," she said. "Maybe sometimes it's better to keep your mouth shut." "Well, how long have you been the vet here?" He twisted his mouth to one side, thinking. "Around 3 years, I think."
"So you started right after my father died?"
"A couple of months before, if I recall. Your father was great with the horses. He really knew his stuff." She shrugged and smiled, not sure what to say. Other than seeing him heading over to the barn, or working outside on fences and equipment, she never knew that side of her father. "If you don't mind me asking," he said, "where have you been the last few years? Away at school? Claude never told me Mr. and Mrs. Blackwood had a daughter."
Julia swallowed. She didn't want to lie, but she didn't want to tell him the truth either.
"I'd rather not talk about it."
"Sorry, sure."
He shoved his hands in his pockets. "So when was the last time you were around the horses?"
"It's been a while.
I wasn't allowed in the barn when I was growing up." He jerked his head back, his eyebrows raised. "What? Why not?" She hunched her shoulders against the cold, or maybe it was against her emotions. "Like I said, my mother loved rules. She said it was too dangerous for a young girl to be in the barn, and it was a business, not a playground. I'm pretty sure she didn't want me in there because she thought I'd cause trouble or ruin something."
Fletcher looked down at his feet as he walked. His brows knitted.
"That's too bad. Most young girls love horses. Would have been good for you."
She studied him out of the corners of her eyes. What made him think that she needed something good for her? Did she look that beaten down? When they reached the round pen, Claude tipped his cap in her direction.
"Morning, Miss Blackwood."
"Please," she said, "call me Julia." Fletcher rested one arm on the fence.
"So, what do you think?"
Inside the pen, three horses ran back and forth, their tails held high, like black flags in the wind. Their coats shined like oil, and their hooves pounded hard on the dirt, making the earth beneath Julia's feet tremble. Seeing the horses up close, a memory came to her. She was 9 years old and homesick from school. Normally, Mother was always home, but that day she had an important appointment in town. Father was supposed to check on Julia when he came in from the barn around noon, but as usual, he went into his den and locked the doors. When Julia crept down to the kitchen to get something to drink, she looked out the window above the sink and saw a black horse in the garden, trampling the tomatoes and eating the lettuce and carrot tops. She ran to the den to get her father and started to knock on the door, then stopped, her knuckles on the wood. On the other side of the double doors, her father was weeping. His favorite record, Little White Lies, turned up loud. She stood for a moment, sick and scared and not knowing what to do, then hurried back to the kitchen, put on her shoes, and went outside. At the edge of the woods, she picked a bunch of clover, then went over to the garden
and slowly approached the horse, her hand outstretched. The horse yanked up its head and snorted, startled by her presence. Talking soothingly, Julia took one step at a time toward it, not making any sudden moves. Finally, the horse took a step forward and nibbled at the pink blossoms in her hand, its soft lips like velvet on her palm. When the horse moved closer, munching the clover and looking down on her with big brown eyes, Julia stepped backward, and the horse followed. She kept going until they reached an empty paddock outside the barn, then opened the gate and led the horse through. After putting the rest of the clover on the ground, she shut the gate, went back to the horse, and ran her fingers through its black mane. The horse nickered and rubbed its heavy head against her side, loving the attention. Overcome by the horse's show of affection, she wrapped her arms around its muscular neck and pressed her nose into its warm hide. It was the first time she had ever touched a horse, and somehow it seemed as though she could feel its strength radiating like the warmth of the sun into her skin. It was like nothing she had ever felt before. On her way back to the house, confusion stirred in her mind. Why would her parents keep her away from such wonderful creatures? It didn't make sense. After that encounter, she looked out her bedroom window every day, aching to be with the horses. Once in a while, when Father wasn't watching and on the rare occasion Mother was out, she snuck over to the fences near the back of the barn. But she only dared to stay a few minutes. Sometimes the horses came over to eat clover out of her hand or let her pet them, but other times they were too busy grazing, running, and sleeping. Either way, she was happy just to be near them. When she ran away from home 3 years ago, the horses were the only thing she missed about Blackwood Manor. Now, seeing these stallions, her stallions, up close, she was surprised to feel the old longing return with such undeniable force. "They're beautiful," she said, a lump forming in her throat.
"We have a buyer interested in the black one, and the one with the white blaze," Fletcher said. "But it's up to you if you want to sell or not." "Not sure if you're aware," Claude said, "but your father bred a lot of blue ribbon winners in his time. Course, it was Mrs. Blackwood who bought the stud that started it all. But these are some of our best stallions yet. All you have to do is say the word, and we can keep them and rebuild our reputation."
Julia had no idea what to do. Her head was spinning with memories and doubts and insecurities. Of course she wanted to keep the horses, but could she really run this farm? Could she really take care of these beautiful animals and make the right decisions for their future? She started. Then she noticed Fletcher studying her, as if trying to read her mind, and her face flushed with embarrassment. Fletcher grinned and turned toward Claude.
"Maybe we should give Miss Blackwood a minute to catch her breath," he said. "After all, she just got here. I know you told the buyer we'd have a decision right away, but the buyer can wait."
Claude scowled and pushed his thumbs into his belt. Julia breathed a sigh of relief and smiled at Fletcher to show her gratitude.
"Can I have a day or two to think about it? I haven't decided anything yet, if I'm selling the horses or keeping them. I haven't even unpacked yet."
Claude's frown deepened.
"You're the boss," he said. "But I'm telling you right now, selling these studs is a big mistake."
Fletcher gave Julia a bemused uh-oh look, then directed his attention at Claude.
"I'm sure Julia will take your advice into consideration, and I'll let the buyer know she'll be making a decision soon."
Then he winked at her and said,
"How about a tour of the barn since you're out here?"
She nodded. "Thanks, I'd like that." She waited to see if Claude was going to say anything else, but he busied himself stomping dirt around the base of a fence pole, brooding silently.
"I'm sorry for not making up my mind right now," she said to him, "but I will, and I know you've got work to do." But after I have a look around, could you please show me how to turn up the furnace? The house is freezing.
Claude moved away from the fence pole and started toward the manor, his face dark.
Yes, ma'am, he said. I'll take care of it right away.
You don't have to do it right now, she said.
Claude ignored her and kept going, his head down.
When he was out of earshot, she glanced at Fletcher.
Did I say something wrong?
Fletcher shrugged.
I have no idea, but I have to admit, I don't think I've ever seen him that cranky.
Chapter 9. Lily. Trying to catch her breath, Lily kicked the door and pounded on the walls inside the tiny dark bathroom inside Merrick's sleeper car. The rough wood tore at her knuckles, and the heavy stench of old urine made her gag.
"Let me out of here!"
she screamed. Muffled voices filtered in through the outer walls of the car as performers and workers left the train on their way to work. She shouted again, then forced herself to stand still on trembling legs, trying to hear above her own labored breathing. Nothing. She closed her eyes and struggled to pull air into her lungs without gagging.
"They'll come back," she thought. "When the show is over, they'll come back."
She pushed her thumbnail into each fingertip. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, over and over again, trying to calm down. In what seemed like forever, her lungs loosened and her breathing returned to normal. But then her muscles started to cramp, like 100 knives in her legs, and the lack of oxygen made her dizzy. She reached blindly for the toilet and sat on the closed lid, her jaw clenched and her shoulders hunched. A little while later, the distant sounds of the big top found their way into the car from outside. Music pulsing, people whistling, clapping, shouting. Several collective intakes of breath and a smattering of nervous shrieks. An elephant trumpeted and children laughed. To distract herself, Lily tried to picture the circus in her mind. The clowns and zebras and elephants and balloons. But what once seemed like a dream had turned into a nightmare, and all she could think about was Abby and going home. She put her head in her hands. There was nothing she could do now but wait. After a while, the outside sounds changed from laughter and happy shouts to quiet talking and the distant clang of metal doors. Finally, the show was over, and hopefully Glory was on her way back to the car. Lily stood and pounded on the door again, even though she knew no one would hear her. Her jaw ached from gritting her teeth, and a sharp stabbing pain throbbed at her temples. She could hardly breathe, she couldn't move, and she didn't know what she would do if she wasn't let out soon. At last, she heard muffled voices outside the car, footsteps coming up the steps, and the door to the passenger car opening. She put her ear against the door and strained to listen.
"Lily?"
a voice called out.
"Where are you?"
It was Glory.
"I'm in here!"
Lily shouted, her voice raspy and hoarse. She banged on the door with both fists. Footsteps raced across the bedroom floor. The handle on the bathroom door rattled.
"Hold on," Glory said. "I'll get you out."
Footsteps hurried across the floor again, and Glory's muffled voice said, "Where's the key, Merrick?" Merrick's muffled voice answered, but Lily couldn't make out his words. Finally, a key rattled in the lock, and the handle turned. The door opened, and light sliced into the dark bathroom. Lily blinked and covered her eyes with one shaking hand, briefly blinded by the glare. Then she bolted across the bedroom and living room and headed for the exit. Merrick blocked her way, grabbing her by the shoulders.
"Where do you think you're going?" he said.
She yanked herself from his grasp and hid behind Glory, breathing hard.
"Leave her alone!"
Glory said.
She's trying to escape again, Merrick said.
Because you locked her in the toilet, Glory shouted. Merrick took a step closer and pushed his face into Glory's, his chin jutting out.
She needs to learn who's boss around here, just like you did.
Glory moved away from him, almost stepping on Lily's toes.
Well, you don't need to lock her up like an animal to prove it.
Merrick scowled at her as if fighting the urge to hit her again, then turned away and took off his jacket, mumbling under his breath. He loosened his bow tie and fell into his chair.
I need a drink.
Glory shot Lily a wide-eyed look and jerked her chin toward the sofa, then went over to the sideboard and poured Merrick a glass of whiskey. Lily went to the sofa and sat on her hands, unable to stop shaking. Glory flashed her another worried look, her lips pressed together in a hard, thin line. Lily wasn't sure if Glory was warning her to keep quiet or if she was concerned about something else, but she planned on staying still and silent anyway. Merrick was just like Mama, and if he was trying to teach her a lesson, it worked. Glory took the drink to him, pushed a footstool over to his chair, took off his shoes, and lifted his feet onto it. Then she knelt beside his chair.
Is there anything else I can do for you? She said. Are you hungry?
Merrick took a long swig of his drink, then looked at Glory with amusement. At first, Lily thought he was going to thank her or give her a kiss. Instead, he abruptly sat up and threw his drink in Glory's face. Lily jumped and shrank back into the sofa, her heart racing again. Glory gasped and blinked, her mouth open in shock.
Yeah? Merrick said to Glory in a mocking voice. There's something else you can do for me. You can stop telling me what to do.
He put the empty glass on the arm of the chair, then stood and stormed into the bedroom. Still on her knees, Glory gazed at Lily with sad, tear-filled eyes, whiskey dripping from her hair and face, mascara running down her cheeks. Lily hung her head and started to cry. After locking her in the bathroom, Merrick kept Lily prisoner in his sleeper car for 3 days. Glory brought her wash water from the changing tent, meals from the cookhouse, and fresh clothes from the Monday man, who stole clothes from clotheslines in nearly every town. And when Merrick finally let Lily out, it was time for her to go to work. After breakfast in the cookhouse, Merrick took her over to the sideshow to see the new canvas banner being hung outside the freak show tent to announce her act. When they arrived, Mr. Barlow, in a top hat and jacket, and Alana, in a powder blue dressing gown, were there, watching the painter put the finishing touches on the giant image. Merrick swore under his breath when he saw it. Lily stared up at it, not sure what to think. In the image, she was 10 feet tall, with her chin held high and her pale hand around a sparkling staff, like a white version of the Bad Queen in Sleeping Beauty. A winter scene surrounded her as she stood in front of an icy spaceship and an igloo. She couldn't imagine why Mr. Barlow wanted people to think she was from another planet. What was she supposed to do, and how was she supposed to act? And what happened if everyone found out they were lying? She thought about asking Merrick, but changed her mind. She'd ask Glory later.
It's perfect, don't you think?
Mr. Barlow said to no one in particular. Alana stood beside him, her fingers and neckline dripping with jewels. She hooked an arm through his and twisted her red lips, staring up at the canvas.
I don't know, darling, she said. It seems kinda... what's the word?
Off. No, no, Mr. Barlow said. It's just what I wanted.
For my show, Merrick said. Mr. Barlow kept his eyes straight ahead.
Yes, it's just what I wanted on my banner, on my tent, on my circus lot.
He swore under his breath, then turned on his heels and walked away, swinging a silver-tipped cane and taking Alana with him.
Come along, darling. Let's celebrate.